Subscribe to the SciBlogs podcast in iTunes or on the SciBlogs website, www.sciblogs.co.nz. Also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at SciBlogsNZ.
On the SciBlogs podcast this week, we preview the 2012 Skeptics Conference, what's preoccupying the country's skeptically minded science enthusiasts, using dynamite to simulate volcanic eruptions, and a birth control pill for men. Welcome to the SciBlogs podcast, episode 40 for Friday, the 17th of August. I'm your host, Peter Griffin, coming to you from the Science Media Centre here in Wellington, and a relatively quiet week on the science front. Which was quite nice after the excitement last week of the Curiosity Mars rover landing and the Tongariro eruption as well created a bit of a stir. But we'll be delving back into volcanoes in this episode. Later I'll be talking to New York-based geologist Professor Greg Valentine, who is detonating explosives to recreate the forces created in the type of volcanic eruptions that create so-called Mars. Now, these are craters common in Auckland at places like Lake Pupuki and Onipoto Basin. There's a new segment where I'll be reviewing a science website each week that's particularly good, in my opinion anyway. You'll love the one that I'm kicking off with, particularly if you're a Facebook user. We're going to hear from the scientists who helped develop a drug that was designed to treat cancer, but which turned out to be a form of male contraception in mice. It's research that may point the way to a birth control pill for men. But first, it's almost that time of year again where the New Zealand Skeptics Society gather to review the latest pseudoscientific scams, conspiracy theories, and attacks on rationality. I've been to three Skeptics conferences. They're always fascinating affairs, intelligent discussion, wry humor, and on occasion some testy exchanges on some quite polarizing view, even for the skeptic community. Christchurch businesswoman and science commentator Vicky Hyde has been the driving force of the Skeptic Society for years and overseen most of the conferences. Her passion for skeptical science hasn't diminished, even as she has had to adapt to life in the wake of the Canterbury earthquakes. Once again, Vicky's got more juicy topics than you can shake a divining rod at.
We've got people talking about evolution and the evolution-creation debate, what sort of problems that can pose for people and how to discuss it. We're having a workshop on how to take successful complaints to the Advertising Standards Authority, because people are getting more and more concerned about the sort of claims that are being made in adverts, particularly online ones, and particularly associated with health products, so it's important we keep an eye on that. We're learning about alternative archaeology and anthropological explanations for New Zealand and some of the weird and wonderful things that people can come up with that, and the potential dangers and pitfalls that are associated with that sort of thing. Stuff about mental health, science communication, a whole host of stuff. We're kicking off with some time spent at Otago Museum, learning more about who we are, where we come from as Kiwis, and, just a good range of topics.
Well, how would you sort of describe the state of scepticism in New Zealand at the moment? For instance, how's your membership base looking? Has it increased in recent years?
Yes, it has. And, of course, with the social media and whatnot, and with the rise of skeptics in the pubs groups up and down the country, we've seen a lot of people affiliated or associated with us, as well as the actual formal membership rise.
And what about the issues that are preoccupying your members at the moment? I see you did some commentary recently on the potential for Chinese traditional medicine to be regulated in New Zealand.
Yes, there's been attempts to do that. And, of course, the problem is if you say that something's regulated but don't actually regulate it, then it gives it a spurious kind of credibility, which can be a real problem. It's very hard, of course, trying to get any kind of changes into legislation, because there's such huge vested interests around particularly alternative health industry. big money there, whether it's the homeopaths or traditional Chinese medicine or a whole host of others that want to be seen as legitimate but don't necessarily want to provide the evidence to actually demonstrate legitimacy.
One of the other big issues that was probably this time last year, around March last year, was huge, was obviously Ken Ring and his earthquake predictions. You were heavily involved in that. Has that sort of died down? Is Ken Ring still attracting any attention in Canterbury?
Well, he doesn't seem to be, as far as I've seen, which is really great. We do have other people who are also predicting earthquakes of one form or another based on crystals or what the CIA apparently is up to. Watch out for August 18th. One of my crystal wavers has predicted that we should have an 8.2 magnitude earthquake at 11 o'clock.
8.2? Good God.
Yeah, I said to this guy last time, you know, he made three predictions, and I said none of them came true. How many times do you have to get it wrong before you decide you're not actually doing what you think you're doing?
Well, that doesn't matter to Ken Ring.
No, it doesn't matter to this guy either. He's got all sorts of reasons for why the last three that he predicted were good. But the problem is he keeps talking about it on the bus in a loud voice and frightening the children. So those kinds of things will always be with us, you know, along with things like the Mayan calendar, you know, claim for the end of the world. But do we just sort of work our way through and, you know, the day after these things are supposed to happen, say, well, you know, we didn't think it was going to happen, and look, it didn't.
Yeah. One that's topical at the moment, again, back on the radar, is vaccination. We've had this coroner's inquest into the young woman who died. Claims from the family there that it's related to the Gardasil vaccine that she took or was given. That the coroner's reserved his decision for a few weeks, but it sort of has reignited debate about this whole issue.
Yeah, I mean, we'll always see that. And the problem is, of course, that I guess in a large population where you're having large numbers of vaccinations, there will always be some people who will suffer what appear to be side effects right up to dying within, you know, a week or so, and it will be blamed on that. Mm. What we've got to keep doing is, of course, keep monitoring to see if there really actually is a connection in anything other than time.
And one of the things I noticed on the agenda for the conference is patients demanding sort of quack treatments, and we have seen a lot of this. There was a very prominent case of the farmer whose family demanded high-dose vitamin C treatment for him. He had pneumonia. He recovered from that and was praising these high-dose vitamin C treatments. So we're increasingly seeing patients saying to the doctors, I need this, or their family saying, you must give it to our sick relative.
That is of increasing concern because it does put the doctors into an ethical dilemma. Often patients will say, well, I'll go and get it somewhere else then. Or they do the stuff off their own bat and don't actually disclose to their real health professionals what they've done. And that can be a real problem with contraindications and interference with medicine that we do know works. It's also a concern that we're seeing insurance companies quite happy to pay out on all sorts of non-evidence-based alternative health products and services because they can make a buck out of it.
Yeah. One of the big issues sort of sitting on the skeptics mailing list, that one of the few issues that really gets debate going, quite heated debate going, is climate change. On the skeptics mailing list, there's some polarised views on that. Is that one that you're likely to see some discussion of at the conference?
No doubt. I mean, it has come up from time to time, both in formal presentations and just sort of around the coffee table. There's a discussion about, you know, should climate change skeptics be allowed to use the word skeptics PM without necessarily being open to full debate and discussion. We've seen the climate change discussion change over the past 10 to 15 years. In terms of what kind of evidence there is for it. I think ultimately the decisions that we make about it, of course, are going to be based on political and economic factors rather than scientific ones.
Mm. At the conference, you hand out awards for the best and worst media coverage of the past year. How do you think the media is doing when it comes to sort of science-related stories? Is coverage improving?
I don't know if it's improving as such. I mean, we do have such a huge churn amongst journalists that we're constantly covering the same stories over and over and over again. I have to say, I try and encourage particularly the broadcast people who are doing documentaries, you know, why do another documentary about a UFO sighting or a haunted house? Why not do the really interesting story, which is, why do we want to believe in ghosts? Why do we assume that if we see something that's inexplicable, of all, we have to jump to an explanation that's not necessarily valid. I mean, I think those kind of psychology factors are far more interesting than, you know, yet another hokey story about this, that, or the other.
Yeah, because the media, and we notice this at the Science Media Centre as well, is under just incredible pressure resource-wise, and we've seen across the Tasman what's happening with Fairfax and News Corp there. They're being slashed, and there will be flow-on effects here. So the actual resourcing of the media to cover an area that's science-related is very limited.
Very limited, and of course it's exacerbated by the fact that most of the people going into journalism aren't actually science-trained or have science backgrounds, so they're not likely to sort of have the necessary detectors for the stories and weird and wonderful claims that are out there. They think they're really onto something magnificent. I often say to Cub reporters, you know, if this story about somebody seeing a ghost is really true, you should be able to sell it as a front-page story to the New York Times, because that would be such an earth-shatteringly changing moment in history. It deserves all the attention that it can get, not, you know, 3 pages in the filler and the features section.
Good point. Just finally, Vicky, we've had a lot of big science-related stories where risk has been central, trying to quantify risk. We've had the earthquakes, we've had Pike River, Rena, all sorts of things. What do you think the public's perception of scientists is in the wake of all of this? Has it changed? Has trust in scientists improved or reduced over the last 18 months or so, do you think?
We have seen, I think, a decrease in trust in scientists over the last 10 years, certainly. Whether we've had another downdrop in the last 18 months remains to be seen. But I think it all sort of ties back to the fact that we're not usually particularly good at assessing risks in a rational fashion. I mean, people will be worried about, say, for example, swimming in the Pacific Ocean because there might be sharks out there, when in fact more people get killed in the Pacific by a coconut dropping on their heads every year than are ever killed by sharks.
Think that's something that's not going to turn around anytime soon, I don't think.
No, often not. And we just have to really be aware of, you know, how rational are our concerns about risks. If we're really concerned about danger, we should all have single-story houses so we don't fall downstairs. They're pretty risky compared to a lot of things.
So, Vicky, just give us the details on the conference, where, when, and how to sign up.
Right. Well, we have all the information available on the Skeptics website, which is www.skeptics.org.nz. That actually has an online booking form, which lets people book straight away and pay online if they want to. They're welcome to rock on up at Otago University at the Archway Theatre there in Dunedin, where the lectures run from September the 1st, that's a Saturday, through to the Sunday. Lots and lots of interesting discussions. And we have our opening on Friday, so they can read all about it on the skeptics.org.nz website.
Any firewalking this year?
No, so sadly, actually, firewalking is quite hard to organise now because there's a hell of a lot more restrictions and regulations and requirements, you know, everything right down to what kind of wood would have put a nasty load on the atmosphere compared to how it was, say, 20 years ago when I first started out.
Preferably in a residential area, should be played at high volume.
Love it or loathe it, Facebook is the place where we are increasingly socializing online. 800 million active users and counting. And you get the sense these days, if you're not on Facebook, you're, well, a bit of a non-entity. There's a lot of science news organisations on Facebook, and one that's occupying my news feed is proving a great resource of science news with a quirky spin. The name, and you'll have to excuse me here, says it all. I fucking love science. It's for people really passionate about science. And having attracted nearly 700,000 followers since March, it's clear there are plenty of those. I fucking love science isn't a website. It exists entirely on Facebook and doesn't create any content of its own. Instead, it links to random science-related photos, quotes, graphics, cartoons, or mashups from around the web. The thing is, there is always something truly hilarious, insightful, poignant, or just plain gross to keep you coming back for more. Take the last week, for example. I came across a great XKCD infographic showing all 786 known planets in scale. A truly stomach-turning, high-definition close-up of the human eye. A picture of the amazing-looking Glaucus atlanticus, a rare and beautiful specimen of sea slug. and my favorite, and many others too, judging by the 12,000 likes it's received, a baby gorilla reacting with surprise to a doctor placing a cold stethoscope on his chest. I Fucking Love Science is the brainchild of Elise Andrew, who works for Lab X, a science media publisher. You can add their updates to your newsfeed just by liking the Facebook page. Be warned, you'll be spending a lot more time on Facebook as a result. That was Professor Greg Valentine of the University at Buffalo, the State University of New York, detonating half a kilogram of explosives underground to simulate the type of explosion that would create a Mar volcanic eruption. Mars are low-profile forms of volcanoes common around the Auckland volcanic field. Now, Professor Valentine's experiments are aimed at giving us a better understanding of the explosive nature of these types of volcanoes, so those of us who live in the shadow of them or near them have a better idea of what to expect when they erupt into life.
I'm just interested in these from a very basic research perspective of trying to understand how these volcanoes work, but I'm also interested in the hazards component. In order to assess the hazards that you might have in a volcanic field, it's important to understand the energies that are associated with these explosions that occur at Mars. So the more energy that's released in an explosion, the more dangerous that explosion is. For the most part, what we're doing is relatively new for volcanoes. We're basically starting up a facility where we can do these sort of larger scale outdoor, you know, experiments where you need to be outdoors. And this was kind of the first series of experiments that we've done there, but we're going to be looking at other processes such as pyroclastic flows and ash plumes.
You focus here on these sort of low profile Mar volcanoes. We have a number of these, particularly in Auckland, a number of those types of craters exist. Why did you focus on those types of volcanoes?
I'm doing research on volcanic fields, and Auckland is, of course, built on a volcanic field. Most of my research is in the western United States right now. And in volcanic fields, there's always some proportion of the volcanoes that are Mar volcanoes. So they form when magma interacts with groundwater explosively. And you basically end up just getting a big crater rather than a mountain, which is what most people think of when they think of a volcano.
Take us through it, Greg. You set up these three test beds, which are packed with gravel, limestone, asphalt. Take us through how you go about recreating the explosive effect that you would see in a typical Mar.
Okay, well, we were trying to ask a very basic, or address a very basic question, and that is whether you can use the diameter of a crater to estimate the energy that was released by individual explosion. There's been experimental work in the past looking at the size of a crater that you can get from a single explosion, and that's, for example, military research. And so there have been experimental results that allow us now to predict the diameter of a crater for a given explosion energy for a single explosion. If that sort of relationship worked at Mar volcanoes, then that would mean that we could go to a Mar and measure its diameter, which is very easy, and then estimate how much energy, say, the largest explosion might have produced. But we were questioning whether that really works when you have multiple explosions. So we had three test beds. In one of them, we did a single explosion, and that was sort of a baseline example. We predicted what the diameter would be, for the crater diameter would be, based on this kind of earlier literature from the military and so forth. And the diameter that we produced with the single explosion was exactly what we predicted. But again, we know that Mar volcanoes have multiple explosions.
Right.
The next question is, well, let's divide that explosion energy into three smaller explosions. The only thing that we're going to vary now is just that we're dividing that energy up into three smaller equal-sized explosions. The total energy that's released, if you add up all three, is going to be the same as the first, as what we had in the first bath. But it's going to be three separate explosions, and they're all going to occur at the same underground location. So in the second pad, we did just that. We had the three smaller explosions. Each one was located at the same location. We set off the first explosion. We went in and sort of measured the the features that it produced, and then we inserted a second explosion, a second charge, tried to get to the same location as the first one, detonated that, then we looked at what happened then, and then we did the third one. There, all we did was we divided the energy up into three smaller explosions, but they all occurred at the same location. And what we saw was that, in the end, the end result was that we had a crater that was similar in size to what we got at the first pad, a little bit smaller, but the size of that crater was not a good indicator of the energy of the individual explosions.
Right.
It might be an indicator of the total energy of all the explosions, but from a hazards perspective, that's not as important as understanding the individual explosions.
Right.
The third pad, we divided the explosions up into three, but we made them at different depths. So we know that at these volcanoes, there are explosions. You get multiple explosions, but they can occur at different depths. But we also know that they can move around sort of in the map view. You know, if you were looking down, the explosion sites can move around. And so that's one of the next set of experiments that we're thinking about doing, is getting more variability in the spatial location of the explosions. We're also, in addition to understanding the craters and the ejecta and the hazards, we're interested in the structures beneath the craters. So most people don't really think about that, but beneath these craters, there are these features called diatremes, which are full of broken up rock and bits of cooled magma and so forth. Those are actually, in some cases, can be valuable sources of diamonds. So we're using these experiments also to try to understand the processes that create these diatremes and kind of govern their structure. So after we did the explosions, we went in and carefully excavated out cross-sections and documented the structures beneath the craters.
And we're talking here in terms of how much explosives you used, roughly about as powerful as a grenade.
First pad was about half a kilogram. And then we divided that into thirds for the second pad.
And in terms of the material that was ejected into the air, Greg, is that a reasonably accurate model for the type of volcanic ash that would come out of a Mar explosion?
Well, probably not as fine-grained as what would come from a Mar explosion. So in some ways, there were some aspects that we were not really simulating, and that specifically the details of the explosion itself. We were just simply saying, if you have an explosion, you know, what's the geometry of the crater that you get? We did get some ash, but I wouldn't say that we were necessarily, you know, mimicking what would really happen in a volcano.
There's been a lot of work done in modeling of volcanic ash and how it spreads. And I think, you know, back in the 91 Pinatubo eruption, scientists did a lot of good work there around modeling the impact of gases in the atmosphere on climate, for instance.
The eruption that occurred in New Zealand, Ruapehu, some really excellent work was done there, actually, comparing, because they were able to go out and collect very detailed data of the ash fallout, the deposit of the ash, and then had really good information about the eruption itself. So it was a good example where you could kind of test the modeling and compare it with real data from the field.
Would this sort of experiment apply or work with sort of the more cone-shaped volcanoes we're used to here in New Zealand?
Mainly what we're looking at is the processes associated with multiple discrete explosions.
Right.
That occur underground. And I've been focusing on the Mar volcanoes, but you could also get that at the summit of a stratovolcano, like Ruapehu.
Right. You've used some pretty sophisticated technology to photograph and model the explosions that were undertaken.
We took high-speed video, and then we also have infrared video that shows temperature. We also measured the seismicity that was produced, so we had seismometers set up at different distances away from each explosion. Finally, the electrical field. So when there's a volcanic explosion, you're creating lots of fine ash, so you're breaking up rock, and then those particles kind of rub together. And those two processes can produce static electricity, basically. So you get an electrical field, and that's related to the amount of fine-grained material. So we're actually using these experiments as a way to test this relatively newer technique of monitoring the electrical field around an eruption.
We've really, at the moment, got a heightened sensitivity towards natural hazards. Do you see that in the population in the U.S.? Are people aware of that there could be earthquakes, there could be volcanoes at any time, and we need to be prepared for them?
Yeah, Yeah, I think people that live in the regions around volcanoes and in regions which are seismically active, which tend to be mostly on the western, the west coast, they are relatively aware. Now, it doesn't happen with the frequency that you see in New Zealand. So we had a big eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980, and then for a few years after that. And, of course, there was a lot of attention, and people were very aware for, say, 5 to 10 years. But then, you know, when you go through these sort of long periods where there's a 20-30 years with no activity, I wouldn't say get complacent, but it just gets kind of low on the radar screen.
So what's next for your research? Are you going to continue to work with explosives?
Yeah, we are. We're actually already beginning to design a more detailed set of experiments looking at craters. And actually, there's a very eminent volcanologist from New Zealand who's involved in this. His name is James White at University of Otago. So he was actually here for the experiments. And then another thing that we're going to start working on is the actual physics of the interaction of magma and water. So we're actually going to be making some volumes of molten magma and mixing it with water in different configurations and seeing what kinds of explosions we get and what the processes are in detail that are associated with that.
One thing you often hear in the media, Greg, quoted when, for instance, Mount St. Helens or a big eruption like that, they'll compare it to so many nuclear bombs going off. How do they come to those conclusions? Is that literally by measuring the size of the crater that's created?
Yeah, at Mount St. Helens, it was basically estimated based on the volume of magma and the heat of the magma. So the energy that produces a volcanic explosion, basically the origin of that energy is just the heat in the magma. And the more magma you have at a certain temperature, the more energy you're going to have. So if you can release that energy very quickly, it's going to give you an explosion. So I think Mount St. Helens was, you know, people use numbers like 30 megatons. It was equivalent to like a 30 megaton or 35 megaton nuclear blast. At Mar volcanoes, people have tried to do that by using this crater diameter. And for a typical Mar volcano, it may be a kilometer in diameter. The crater may be a kilometer in diameter. And if you estimate the sort of explosion energy that you would need from a single explosion to get that diameter, it would be maybe something like 2 to 3 megatons. So it would be equivalent to 2 or 3 megatons of a, you know, with a nuclear explosion, which is huge.
It is huge, yeah.
I can't remember what Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but they were like 20 kilotons or something like that.
Right.
So we're talking orders of magnitude bigger. But the problem is that we know that those Mar craters are produced by multiple explosions. And so if you actually looked at the energy of individual explosions that make a Mar crater, they're much smaller. They're still very significant and very hazardous.
Hello, I'm Karen Carniel, Deputy Editor of Cell, and you're listening to a Cell Paperclip. Condoms. Their use has been documented for centuries, and yet they've remained virtually the only non-surgical option for male contraception. Meanwhile, technology for female contraception comes in many shapes and forms. The diaphragm, the IUD, the pill, the patch, implants. Is this the way it has to be? Today we'll talk with Jay Bradner of Harvard Medical School about his group's progress towards developing a birth control pill for men. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Sure, appreciate the invitation.
So your Cell paper starts with the hypothesis that a small molecule called JQ1 could be a male contraceptive. Can you tell us what's JQ1 and why did you think it could prevent pregnancy?
JQ1 is a new small molecule inhibitor of a bookmark placed throughout human genomes at regions of chromatin that are associated with gene activation. And we developed JQ1 in my laboratory first as a cancer therapeutic with the idea that we might cause cancer cells to forget, in effect, that they're cancer by removing memory marks systematically from chromatin through cell division. In studying JQ1's effect on the bromodomain family against which it was designed, we observed high selectivity of JQ1 in one particular branch of the molecular phylogeny called the BET subfamily. This includes proteins BRD2, 3, 4, and BRDT. Our index paper on JQ1, published about 2 years ago in Nature, demonstrated the contribution of BRD4 inhibition toward the eradication of a BRD4-addicted cancer. But at that time, learning that JQ1 had almost equal potency for BRDT availed the opportunity to use JQ1 as a chemical genetic probe of BRDT function. In reading about BRDT, we learned that BRDT is restricted in its expression to testicular tissue, which is where it gets the T in its name. Prior genetic studies in humans and also in mice seem to suggest a role for BRDT in spermiogenesis. Homozygous mice that lacked the first bromodomain mutant, so-called hypomorphs, were created by the Wolgamuth lab at Columbia University. And heterozygous male mice had normal fertility, whereas homozygous mice were infertile. Well, a genetic lesion, such as losing the first bromodomain, is of course an intractable situation for a mouse. But we reasoned that perhaps a small molecule directed at BRDT, incapacitating the first bromodomain function, might be a reversible form of male contraception.
Okay, so the idea is JQ1 inhibits the function of a critical chromatin protein, its bromodomain, in the testes. What happens when you actually treat male mice with JQ1?
Very interesting. When male mice are exposed to JQ1 at a healthy dose of 50 milligrams per kilogram, we observe a dose and time-dependent decrease in numerous parameters associated with fertility. The definitive fertility studies were performed by our dear friend and collaborator Marty Matzik at Baylor College of Medicine, who's a co-corresponding author on this study. What Marty observed in his specialized laboratory was a time and dose-dependent decrease in testicular mass that structurally was associated at the immunohistochemical level with a depletion of mature spermatocyte. We observed no major toxic effect in other critical tissues of the body. There appeared to be a specific and a substantial decrease in the sperm mass.
And what about when you actually mate these mice with females?
We performed a number of mating studies in the course of these experiments. And it is unambiguous that mice receiving JQ1 at a low or high dose regimen so as to target BRDT in the testes are infertile after 1 to 2 months of therapy. And as they remain on JQ1, their infertility persists. However, when you withdraw JQ1, within 1 or 2 months, depending on the exposure to the drug, fertility is recovered. And in fact, the male mice go on to sire pups in litters of normal sizes, and importantly, animals with no overt phenotypic abnormalities.
So a lot of female contraceptives alter hormonal levels in the female. Is that what's going on at all here with JQ1 in the male mice?
You're bringing up a really important point. Like in female contraception, there is a contraceptive effect observed in humans, male humans, who receive agents that modulate the function of the testosterone hormonal axis. And it was therefore very important that we rule out that JQ1 was having a systemic effect on a testosterone elaboration. Importantly, male mice treated with JQ1 exhibited no alteration in their levels of luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, or testosterone. These data reinforce the idea that JQ1 is conferring an anti-spermatogenic and infertile effect reversibly through effects on the spermatogenic compartment only.
Right. Okay, so this is a provocative discovery. What would you think would be the roadmap for developing JQ1 into a product that could be prescribed to men, much the way hormonal contraceptives are widely prescribed for women?
Well, ever since my wife gave birth to twins 1.5 years ago, I've been taking 1 gram a day. Of course, I'm kidding. JQ1 has been developed as an anti-cancer therapeutic for its inhibitory function on BRD4. And while this molecule is well tolerated now, as we know, by numerous species, it lacks the selectivity for BRDT that would be a prerequisite for a mature therapeutic product utilized as a male contraceptive. With a plan to treat patients who are otherwise healthy and for contraceptive benefit, such a pharmaceutical compound would have to be extraordinarily clean and have extremely limited toxicity. Therefore, this study we regard as pharmacologic target validation that really declares open season on BRDT as a male contraceptive target.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us, and congratulations to you and your coworkers on a really fascinating study.
Well, on behalf of Marty and my laboratories, we thank you for the opportunity.
Great. Well, you can check out the paper by Matt Sook et al. In the August 17th issue of Cell or on cell.com. I'm Karen Carniel, and you've been listening to a Cell Paperclip.
That was audio from the Cell Journal podcast there, and that's our show for another week. Check out the show notes for all of those stories at cyblogs.co.nz. Send us your feedback in the comments or via the feedback form on the blog. And join us next Friday for another dose of science news and views with a distinctly Kiwi spin here on the Cyblogs podcast.